Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about educating and organizing around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. So one of the things we were calling for during 2020 is to cancel all student debt and set up a fair student borrowing program run by the federal government, zero interest with reasonable payback. And then after you pay for a certain number of years, forgiveness of any remaining debt. And the Biden came partly toward what we were talking about this week. And, you know, before we get into the details of that, it's important to realize that it has been the public policy of the United States since the 1970s to make college too expensive so that not that many people get a college education. You know, in the coming out of World War II, the GI Bill, and then a lot of state universities and colleges were tuition free or basically tuition free. And as we went into the 70s, particularly the conservatives in the political elites got concerned because there's a lot of student unrest. And, you know, coming from these better educated young people who were in the colleges, you know, over Vietnam, over civil rights, starting to raise environmental issues. What's his name? Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court justice, wrote a memo to the US Chamber of Commerce saying that, you know, too many people are involved in politics now, black people, women, environmentalists, and he really blamed Ralph Nader for mobilizing consumers. And, you know, as a result, the business class got organized. There was the Business Roundtable and the Trilateral Commission and all these lobbies that we know of today. The Chamber of Commerce, of course, was older, but it got more engaged politically. And one of the things they did was make it too expensive for a lot of working class people to go to college. Or if they did, they would be enormously indebted. So there's this guy, Roger Freeman, who was kind of a ideologue for capitalism. He was a policy advisor to both Reagan and Nixon. And in 1970, he said this, quote, and this is in California, where tuition was basically free at the state colleges and universities. He said, quote, "We are in danger of producing an educated proletariat. That's dynamite. We have to be selective on who we allow to go to college. If not, we will have a large number of highly trained and unemployed people," end quote, which means, you know, people well-educated, know their way around, you know, politics and government and how to organize, and that would be a threat to the establishment. You know, how about a job guarantee instead of worrying about, you know, unemployed college educated people? Instead, you know, the policy decision was made to keep us ignorant so we are not able to organize and change society. And I'm going to put a Twitter link. I did a tweet about this yesterday because that quote comes from an article by John Schwartz in The Intercept yesterday. And so the tweet, you know, basically makes the comment I just made and then links to that article. You might want to read that because it's informative. And I didn't put the link together, but Tom Hartman had another article yesterday about, you know, how basically the Republicans in particular pushed to raise college tuition. I think Hartman lets the Democrats off too easy because, you know, like here in New York, you know, Mario Cuomo and Andrew Cuomo have run the state except for a little Republican interlude. And, you know, tuition costs at public university and college have gone way up. So, you know, you can't blame it all on the Republicans. It's really been a, you know, a bipartisan policy, although the Republicans have certainly been the most vocal about it, maybe the most honest. I think what I said in that tweet is that this guy, Roger Freeman, the policy advisor to Reagan and Nixon, said the quiet part out loud in that statement that I quoted. So let's look at, you know, what actually happened with this student debt cancellation. So the pause on paying off loans goes to the end of this year. It's extended. Pell Grant recipients will be eligible up to $20,000 in debt cancellation if they're earning less than $125,000 for a single person or $250,000 for a couple. That will cost the federal government about $300 billion over 10 years. And then non-Pell grant recipients will be eligible for up to $10,000 in debt cancellation, again, if they're earning less than $125,000 if they're single or $250,000 if they're a couple. That maybe will cost another $200 billion. The estimates are still coming out, but we're talking basically about $500 billion in cost to the federal government over 10 years, or $50 billion a year. Given the size of the federal budget, that's not that great. 90% of the debt cancellation will go to those earning less than $75,000 a year, so it's targeted at those without a lot of great income. So it eliminates the debt for 20 million and helps another 23 million out of 43 million total people with student loans. They're going to benefit to some degree. Another change is that people who are in the income-driven repayment system, which is basically your repayment is scaled to your income, the maximum they have to pay was reduced from 20% today to 10%. I'm sorry. The number of people in this program has increased from 10% of all student borrowers to about a third of all student borrowers today. So this is a growing program. And the income that's covered in this income-driven repayment system increases from 150% to 225% of the poverty line. So more people will be able to get into this program. And then the interest on these income-driven repayment loans is reduced to 0%, which it should have been all along. The point of, you know, lending money to students was to help them go to college, not make, you know, profits off them, you know, income for the government. There are other ways to do that that are more fair. So those with, another change is that those with undergraduate loans, the cap on their repayment in this income-driven repayment program is 5% of monthly income, down from what it was before, 10%. And then the total balance is forgiven after 10 years of payment, whereas before it was 20 years. But that's only for borrowers with loan balances of $12,000 or less. So these are all, aimed at the lower income people who have loans and are struggling to pay. But still a lot of people, even with better income, it's still a real burden. And, they're not getting as much help. Now, the thing, and this is pointed out, let's put this in the chat. It's a link to an analysis by Matt Bruning of the People's Policy Project. And he says, you know, the way this thing is structured, it's going to bring more students into the income-driven repayment program, which is good. But what this program is doing is accelerating the inflation of college costs, because colleges, and particularly law schools, have figured out that they can raise the cost of college, get more of this income-driven repayment program money, put some of it aside, and then actually as part of the scholarship program, make those payments and still make money for the college. So it pays for them to increase tuition. With forgiveness of 5%, after 5% of income for 10 years, total forgiveness, the colleges can maximize tuition and needed loans and put some of that tuition fee money, that loan money, into a fund to pay the students' loan payments. And as I mentioned, law schools are already doing that. Now, other schools, this system structures incentives for them to do that. And this is going to happen unless we have price controls on the cost of college education, like Australia does. They have a maximum amount you can charge for any particular given program of study. And if we want to control college costs, you know, that's what we're going to have to do. So, you know, I would say Biden's debt cancellation is a step in the right direction, but it's still far short of the goals we were talking about in our campaign, which are cancel all the student debt, set up a fair loan program going forward through the public sector, zero interest, adjusted for inflation on the principal, and then, you know, 5% of income paid monthly, and after 10 years, forgive whatever is remaining. And, you know, students are still going to need loans, even if tuition is free at public colleges, which we also call for, because there needs to be living expenses. Although, you know, we would suggest that we need a living stipend, for, at least for the undergraduate. For a living stipend along with the tuition payments, like the original GI Bill coming out of World War II. I mean, those people coming back from the war not only had their tuition paid, they got stipends, supported whole families with that. And, you know, a lot of people took advantage of that. And there was a joint study of by the Joint Economic Committee, House and Senate. And they found that for every dollar invested in the GI Bill, it returned $7 in economic growth to the economy. So it was a good investment. It paid off in spades. So, and then we need, you know, the price controls like they have in Australia. If we did that, then everybody who wants to would be able to, you know, take advantage of a college education. And, you know, the problem that the right wing is worried about, you have a bunch of college educated people that are unemployed or dissatisfied. Well, good. You know, we can organize to make the other change. So I think that's my evaluation of this student debt forgiveness. You know, it's a step in the right direction, but we got much more to do. The other thing I'll note before opening up for questions and comments is that, you know, the Greens, now that most of the petition drives are done, ended up doing pretty good on ballot access, despite the barriers that the Democrats in particular put in front of us. We won in North Carolina. The terrible behavior by the Democrats on the North Carolina Board of Elections was overturned by the courts. Oliver Hall from the Center for Competitive Democracy wrote a great lawsuit. You can get that from the North Carolina Greens, probably. I mean, it's written so clearly that you don't have to be a lawyer to read it, like a lot of these briefs. And, you know, the judge commented before he rendered his decision that the Democrats don't come here with clean hands, because they clearly tried to keep the Greens off the ballot by devious and turned out illegal means. And then we were successful in Pennsylvania. I went down and helped them one weekend. Massachusetts, Missouri, New Mexico did it earlier in the year. Really, the only state where we've got a problem is New York. As I've mentioned here before, there were seven attempts, or eight attempts counting us, to get another ballot line on a ballot. Some of them were for the Democrat or Republican Party, but most of them, well, all but one of them were for other parties. None succeeded. The Republican cheated. His name's Lee Zeldin. He voted against certification of the 2020 presidential election as a member of the House, calling fraud, and then he committed, you know, the most obvious fraud, and he got caught. He photocopied petition sheets worth over 11,000 signatures and then sprinkled them through his whole petition. He was trying to get over 45,000 signatures. He got caught. In fact, the latest reporting is they did that in Republican headquarters in Albany. So we've been calling for their indictment for election fraud. And the Democratic Attorney General and the Democratic DA in Albany, they know about it, but they haven't moved yet. And, you know, we're wondering if and when they're going to move. So our status here, you see the poster behind me. The Greens nominated me for governor. I'm running with my lieutenant governor running mate, Gloria Matera. We have a hearing before the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on September 6th about our lawsuit. We lost at the district level with a judge who practically, basically slept, literally seemed to be sleeping through our presentation in that hearing. And, you know, we're arguing on First Amendment and 14th Amendment grounds that the burdens to get on a ballot here in New York are violating our equal protection, 14th Amendment, and First Amendment political association and free speech rights. I think the case is clear because they're asking us to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days, which is off the charts in terms of other parts of the United States or even the world. I think I pointed out here before the nearest comparable petition we can find is if you want to run as an independent for the state Duma in Russia, that's their national parliament, you need 15,000 signatures in 45 days. The old New York standard was 15,000 in 42 days. So we have a bill we've shopped around to Democratic legislators, none of them have picked it up yet, that would bring us back to the old standard. And I joke with them, we just want to get back to the Putin standard. And they chuckle and say we're right and then say we're not going to do it until after the election because we don't want the governor and the state party chair on our backs. So we'll see what happens. We are going to run a write-in if we don't get on the ballot. And in this race in New York, you have two crooks. We got, Lee Zeldin, I just described his thing. Governor Hochul has a penchant for giving money to donors. We've had a Buffalo Billion that Cuomo did. It was a scam. And now there's a second Buffalo Billion for the Buffalo Bills billionaire to build a stadium. In July and early August, there were two cases came out where she gave contracts to companies whose leadership gave hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations. And these contracts were worth hundreds of millions, $1.6 billion in one case. So it's clear pay to play. And, so we're running against two crooks who ideologically Hochul is a corporate centrist, kind of liberal on social issues, conservative on economic issues. And Lee Zeldin's a right-wing extremist, a Trump guy. And so there's a huge vacuum on the left. And we hope to fill that. If we're on the ballot, we definitely can get a lot of votes. Write-in's tougher, but we're going to, get our voice out there and give people the option. So, but the good news is outside of New York, Greens got on the ballot everywhere they were trying. So that, brings us to about 20 states where we're on the ballot for these statewide elections this year. And of course, if we or when we run a presidential candidate in 2024, that still leaves 30 states. Massive job to get on the ballot, unlike any other country. But, we will fight to get on the ballot and also fight to change the laws. We need a federal law for fair ballot access. The last law that would have set a federal standard for federal elections that was a good proposal was from old John Conyers, the former Democratic representative from Detroit. It's called the Fair Elections Act. That was introduced in 1989. And there's just been no interest among the politicians of the two parties in making ballot access fair. So that's why we need the Green Party to bring these issues to the fore. So I'll stop there and look for your questions and comments. Amy L. Sachs, are there any states with Green Party folk on the ballot where they'll actually be allowed into debates? Also, will more local candidates be on the show in the future? The answer to the second part is yes. I have a candidate in mind that I'm going to contact this week and hopefully get that candidate on within a couple of weeks. And anybody who knows a local candidate that, would be good to put on this program, let us know. And then as far as debates go, it varies from state to state. And I don't know the status in any particular states. I can tell you in my experience, sometimes we get in and sometimes we don't. What happens is, and this is the shame of the media, is they won't even talk to us about being in a debate until they get the lead candidate, which in this case is a Democrat. So for example, in 2006, I ran against Hillary Clinton for the US Senate. The issues were the war in Iraq, single payer healthcare, and a Green New Deal. We didn't call it that then, but it was about climate action and economic justice. And she didn't want to debate. She told the media, I will debate the Republican, who was a hopeless former mayor of Yonkers, New York. And in fact, when he showed up at the debate, we had a demonstration outside. We had a good 100 people. And the slogan was 1, 2, 3, 4, Clinton voted for the war, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is not a real debate. And the Republican walked up to us and he said, gee, where are my people? You know, he didn't even have people there to, you know, say anything or support him. The Clinton people, of course, had their machine people down the block. The police were keeping us separated. So that's how weak that candidate was. But I didn't get in the debate because Clinton dictated to the media. Then in 2010, Andrew Cuomo was the Democrat running for governor. And he said that time it was in his interest to have us all debate. So that was a debate, kind of got a little notoriety because Jimmy McMillan, the rent is too damn high, would say a bunch of gibberish and then say the rent is too damn high, which everybody agrees with. And there were 8 of us. There was a woman who, Roger Stone, who was also running the Republican, was running a woman on a so-called Prohibition Party who claimed to have been the woman that set our Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, up with prostitutes, which the Attorney General paid for with his credit card. I mean, that's just hubris because he knows that's easy to trace. And he got caught and he had to resign in disgrace. So, you know, she was in it. There was a Libertarian. There was a Freedom Party candidate, which was, you know, basically a Black party that Charles Barron from Brooklyn was running on. And so there are 8 of us. And I got to debate and came in 3rd in the election. In 2014, we also had a debate that year. There's just 4 of us, Green, Libertarian, Democrat, Republican. But Cuomo had it in Buffalo, New York on NPR, where or PBS, where a few people would see it. But he was easy. I was in the position that debate where it was Republican, Cuomo, me, Libertarian. And they kept going in that order. So the Republican would attack Cuomo from the right. He'd defend himself from the right. Then I'd attack him from the left. And, you know, he was easy to attack. And then the Libertarian, who was not the best candidate, would say something that nobody quite knew what to do with. Then the Republican would attack Cuomo from the right again. Cuomo would defend himself and come to me again, and I'd be able to attack Cuomo, and he never got a chance to respond. So a lot of people said I won that debate. So in 2018, Cuomo decided he wasn't going to debate, really. And in fact, I ran into him in Central Park. MSNBC was having this sort of corporate charity program, and they wanted us third-party candidates to speak. We were kind of the bait to get Cuomo to come because at first he wouldn't come. So they gave us 1 minute. I took 2 minutes. And then Cuomo got 5 minutes. And of course, MSNBC, when I was speaking, switched to a human interest story about some Olympians who got pregnant and wasn't covering. And Cuomo came on and they covered him. So anyway, I ran into Cuomo backstage as he was coming in. And I said, Governor, I'm looking forward to our next debate. And his brow furrowed. And he said, what debate? Like his staff hadn't told him about something coming up. I said, we should have a series of debates. And then he realized that there was no debate. So he said, what, are you going to organize it yourself? And I said, if I have to. So we did get the League of Women Voters to organize an all-comers debate. The Republican came, Libertarian, Serve America Movement, which is now merged into this Forward Party with Andrew Yang. Their candidate was there. Cuomo didn't show. And of course, because he didn't show, the media didn't cover it, at least broadcast it. There was some news reporting, you know, written reports. So that's the point. The media determines whether we get in or not. And they determine whether we get in or not because they listen to what the top candidate or candidates in the race will say, the Democrats and Republicans. And that's not the way the media should. They should let the debate happen and report on it, not decide who's viable and who's not. I mean, here in New York, and I often tell this to reporters, you know, who say, well, my editor doesn't want to cover you so much because you can't win. And this is a state where the Democrats dominate. I say the Republicans can't win, but you cover them. So, yeah, we got a one-party state. They got the governorship, the Democrats do, and super majorities in both the House and the Senate, or the Assembly and the Senate. And they still can't get single payer health care, which they've been the assembly side Democrats have voted for constantly since 1992, I think, until they got the Senate majority, when they could actually do it. And now it can't even get out of committee. So the question on debates is really a question, will the media, what the media should be doing is organizing the debates and then telling the candidates, here's the deal. Instead, the media goes to the top candidate, you know, in this state, it's a Democrat, and says, what do you want to do? And we're only included if that candidate wants us included. So that's a problem. And, you know, every state has its own battles, its own media. And, you know, we should be fighting to get in. The presidential debates, there may be an opening because the Republican National Committee voted to not participate in the debates organized by the so-called Commission on Presidential Debates, which has been a nonprofit controlled by the Democratic and Republican parties to keep out everybody else. And that's been going on since they muscled aside the League of Women Voters in the 1980s. Now the Republicans aren't participating. So that maybe opens up things for the presidential election in 24. So it's a long answer to a short question, but I think, you know, we can get in debates. We have got into debates. You know, Jill Stein tells a story how she got in debate in Massachusetts, and the online poll done by the public radio network there said she won, which, you know, beating Mitt Romney and whoever the Democrat was. So she got in and did well. So, you know, it's really important that we get into those things, and we have, and we should, and we got to fight to get in. So that was a long answer to a short question. Tom Bradburn, Jill Stein in 2016 proposed forgiving student debt. Is her way the same as Biden is doing? Well, yes, she did propose that. Unfortunately, she said it wouldn't cost the federal government anything. And that's not true. The government would be foregoing the debt repayment because most of these loans are owned by the federal government and the interest that they were projected to get. And I didn't, I could have, I should have brought this link. In 2018, this woman, Stephanie Kelton, an economist who has advised the US Senate, Bernie Sanders, she's an advocate of modern monetary theory. She did about a 17-minute presentation on a paper they wrote on how to do it. But she does note that the Green Party candidate couldn't explain how to do it. And in fact, Jill said it wouldn't cost the federal government anything, which is not true. It will cost. But, you know, Kelton, it's worth digging that up. I think it's the name of the paper that she did the presentation based on is called The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation, Levy Institute at Bard College. So you can find that. And it goes into the mechanics of how you could do it. You could do it either through the Treasury or through the Fed. The Treasury is more likely politically. And, you know, it would basically cancel debts. You could spread it out over time. So as each payment comes due, you forgive it. But that comes, you know, that's a debit on the federal balance sheet. So it will cost the government something. And the Fed could do the same thing. It could buy up the loans and then forgive them. But that will also show up on the federal balance sheet. Now, Kelton did say, well, you could get creative and say it costs nothing by just doing an accounting trick if you did it through the Fed and say, how did she put it? They're delaying debt payment. And so the debt is always, it's on there, it's on the books as an asset, but they're never collecting. And you just leave that indefinitely. That's one way to do it, zero. And the other way is to have the Fed buy a bunch of other bonds, you know, corporate or government bonds, the income of which could cover for the losses by not getting the student loan payments. So anyway, and what Biden is doing is forgiving the loan. So it is costing the government. I gave those numbers. It's about $500 billion or $500 billion a year for 10 years. Which, given the size of the federal government and actually the macroeconomic benefits in increased employment and GDP, that the Kelton, okay, it's in the, okay, the macroeconomic, that's the, it's in the chat. So thanks for posting that. And if you can find the YouTube presentation, which is probably quicker than reading that very academic, abstruse, mathematical paper, that would probably be, for most people, the best way to, you know, get a grasp of how it would happen. Kelton is very clear in that video. And Jean Lowe's Pascalades, I see this in the chat. She posted it actually to my personal website. That's how I actually, thank you, Jean. I did watch that video because I've been interested in that question. And yeah, you're pointing out, yeah, what I just pointed out, that the Fed could offset the cost by buying revenue producing stuff. In other words, bonds, you know, corporate bonds and government bonds that would generate income for the Fed. So it would offset the cost. So yeah, student debt. I mean, it's affordable. It's not free, but it's affordable to cancel it. A. Jones, 35. Joe Biden went at student debt at a 4 when we need a 10. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. A 4, I make it more like a 3 because he didn't broach tuition-free public college. He did call in his campaign for tuition-free community college, and that was part of Build Back Better, which got cut. And he didn't talk about it when we talked about student debt relief. So, yeah, 3 or 4. That's a good way to put it. Steve Talbot, if you have a degree that doesn't lead to a job and you have a debt that can't be repaid, you become a wage slave that can't be escaped. Yeah, somebody pointed out in the comments to my tweet that, you know, more people are going to college because they need a white-collar workforce in the service industry, you know, sort of the, and it's not really the service industry, it's the sort of administrative, technical class. And they do, but there are more people getting educated than are jobs in those sectors. So a lot of those well-educated people do work in the service sector. You know, they become, what do they call them at Starbucks? The people that serve, you got a name for them, baristas, I think. Yeah, so they're making, you know, so what are they doing? They got a college education. They're working a crappy job. They're organizing unions. That's what the conservatives were afraid of. So they didn't want too many of us to get educated. And you're right, Steve, if your degree doesn't get you to a good job in the field you studied for and you have a big debt, yeah, you become a wage slave and you're giving your money. It goes to, in most cases, the government who's making money off of you when the point of the loan is to get you an education, not make you a profit opportunity. And then some loans are in the private sector. I think it's more, it's something like 90% are government and 10% are private. And so they're making money off you while you slave away at a low wage job and you're kind of stuck in debt because you really can't pay it off. That's a problem. Eric Gray, as teachers, we are blamed for students being radicalized given what they are clearly seeing in the breakdown of capitalism. Thoughts on this? That's what that conservative guy, Roger Freeman, was afraid of. You know, people will actually get educated, get an analysis of the system and realize we need to change it. And teachers get blamed for radicalizing students. I mean, they are helping them understand the system. Maybe the system needs to be blamed for radicalizing students, or maybe we should praise students getting radicalized, you know, radical in the sense of going to the root causes of the structure in the structure of the system. Now, of course, you know, teachers are getting attacked for educating students so they can, you know, have those insights. And that's why we get the attack on so-called critical race theory, which isn't being taught in the, you know, public schools K through 12. What they're really concerned about is, you know, teaching Black history, the real history of this country, and students understanding that, you know, those inequalities are still structured into the system. And that is something that, you know, the right doesn't want people to understand and resist. So we need to defend the teachers' right to teach reality, you know, what really happened, and let the students draw their own conclusions. Steve Talbot, if the Civil War led to emancipation and the Great Depression led to social programs and the Civil Rights Movement led to greater rights, how did conservatives counter improvements every time? Well, the capitalists backed the conservatives. So they're well-financed. They're well-organized in the sense that they hire competent people to do their lobbying and their public propaganda narrative. And so they are good at dividing us by race, by, you know, native versus immigrant, different sectors of the working class. So, you know, they feel like one sector's got a better deal than the other, like public employees compared to private employees are unorganized, don't have a union. So those private sector workers are encouraged to resent the public sector workers and fight them getting a decent salary. It's been successful. Teachers, you know, are underpaid grossly in this country compared to other countries. They're not valued. And now we have a teacher shortage because between the harassment they're getting from these, you know, the grassroots conservative movement and the disrespect they're getting in the, you know, sort of blogosphere or, you know, the political, what do they call it, where the talking heads are, the, you know, the political debates. And the low salaries, you know, people are looking for other work. So the conservatives, they had money, they had the establishment. You know, there was a Open Secrets had a study I peeked at this week. You know, they follow campaign financing, and they pointed out that I forget how many millions have been poured into election deniers by, you know, mainstream corporations. Including my former employer, UPS. That's the one that stuck out in my mind, but they're big corporations. I can't remember the others, but they're, you know, everyday household names. The corporate sector, and I don't think there's so much into election denial as these people are also very conservative when it comes to economic class issues. And that's what the capitalists concern care about. You know, they don't want to be taxed. They don't want to be taxed to pay for social benefits for the masses of people, whether it's healthcare or education or public transportation or affordable housing or any of the things that we need. So, you know, that's how the conservatives did it. They went to their capitalist sponsors and got the money. And, you know, they've been at it through their well-funded. They've been doing this. As I pointed out earlier, it really got going in the 70s. I mean, we've had business lobbyists and rich people backing major party candidates, but it became, the capitalist class became well-organized and class conscious in the 1970s as a reaction to the civil rights and peace and environmental movements of the 60s. It came out in the 1960s. So by the 70s, they were organizing their counter-revolution, and they largely won. You know, by the end of the 70s, the Democratic Party was a neoliberal party, not a New Deal party. They were New Democrats, as Clinton eventually called them, and joined the Republicans in cutting social programs, expanding military spending. So, you know, domestic austerity, imperialism abroad, and the environment, forget about it. You know, that's just an impediment to business. So even though the science and the capitalists knew it, said climate change could become a serious problem, and all these toxics that we're putting out could be serious. They didn't want to hear about it because they wanted to basically use the environment as a dumping ground for their toxic waste and their global heating emissions. And so that's what we've had for the last 50 years. And then people wonder why the Green Party's out here, quote unquote, spoiling elections, because we're getting no answers from either party. And both of them have adopted the basic conservative arguments on economics and foreign policy. The debates are about, you know, cultural and social issues. So, you know, voting rights for Black people, marriage rights for gay people. Those are things that the Democrats are for and the Republicans are against. So they fight about that and get us all worked up about that. And meanwhile, they agree on the, you know, kitchen table issues and the foreign policy issues. And so, you know, alternative perspectives on that that the Greens bring is difficult to bring, you know, because of the electoral system that we've talked about. So, you know, that's how the conservatives do it. They got paid. Comments on the release of the Trump affidavit. Well, he had a bunch of stuff he shouldn't have. He's broken a number of laws. So, you know, my question is, how soon before Merrick Garland indicts? And if he doesn't, I mean, that's just another argument why, you know, the Greens need to step up and get some power, because this happens over and over again. You know, rich people, Republicans as well as Democrats, break the law. Everybody sees it. And then nothing happens. I mentioned Lee Zeldin, election fraud, submitting these fraudulent signatures, photocopying pages and sticking them in his petition so we have enough signatures. And he hasn't been indicted. As far as we know, there's no further investigation going on other than what the Board of Election did in verifying a complaint that was filed about Zeldin's petition. So we see these people. I mean, and Trump has done it his whole life. I mean, we've been following him in New York forever. He doesn't pay his workers, his contractors, his vendors. He, you know, obviously, and Michael Cohen, you know, had firsthand knowledge of this, but David K. Johnson, the journalist, has documented a lot of this. Bank fraud, insurance fraud, and tax fraud. It's all over the place. He overstates his assets when he's going to get a bank loan or insurance, and he understates them when he pays his taxes. And so he's like keeping two sets of books. I mean, this stuff is so obvious. Not to mention all the money laundering that he's done for Russians going back to the 80s. I mean, a lot of journalists have documented that. And he's still walking around. They may get him on this. I mean, a lot of the commentary now is Merrick Garland has no choice but to indict. But we'll see. You know, the thing that this Trump affidavit and what it shows Trump had, to the extent they could reveal details, it more just describes categories of stuff he had. You know, that he's violated a lot of laws. He shouldn't have had them. There may be other problems, you know, in terms of what he did with it. That requires investigation. So the question is, you know, will the Democrats, who do have the power to indict, will they indict him? I'll give you another example, and David K. Johnson pointed this out. The newly elected district attorney of Manhattan inherited a case on criminal charges against Trump for bank insurance and tax fraud. And he dropped the case or put it on hold, saying he didn't like the evidence. Now, the prosecutors were two of the most experienced people in white collar crime. They defended the crooks as well as prosecuted them. And they resigned in protest. Now, that could have, Democratic governor of New York could have mandated that case be, you know, taken from the Manhattan DA and given to the state attorney general, a Democrat. Or the state attorney general could have asked the governor to do that for her. Hasn't happened. Now, there's been some new evidence, and the New York DA has had to look at it again. But that's another case where the Democrats had the power to go after Trump, and they backed away. So that's my concern. Are they going to follow through and get Trump on what we can all see with our lying eyes he did? Steve Talbot, if I don't have a Green Party candidate on the ballot, how can I find out about Green Party candidates in my local area to use as write-ins? Well, contact your local Green Party. And I don't know, you know, what state you're in or what city you're in, but you can find out who there is. I often, unless I think I need to vote for, you know, usually a Democrat to stop a crazy Republican in some race, I write in Greens. And in New York, they count those and they report them and the newspapers report them. So it makes a statement. Your vote is your voice. So I think, yeah, find out who the candidates are, or even if they don't have candidates, you know, write in some people that will make a statement about, you know, the kind of policies that you want the government to have. The guy behind the curtain, I know Violet keeps thanking Andrea. Actually, she's not doing it anymore, at least for a while. It's Chris Blankenhorn. He's taking care of a baby, so that may have diverted his attention. So I'm looking here in the chat. Oh, he's back. Steve Talbot. Would it benefit the U.S. Green Party to coordinate with Green parties in other countries? I think so. The National Green Party actually withdrew from the Green Parties of the Americas. There's some Latin American parties that are very conservative, even on social issues like abortion and gay rights. But I think we'd have been better off to stay and fight. The National Committee decided to withdraw. You know, the American Greens have been disappointed in some of the, you know, militaristic policies of particularly the German Greens when they backed the intervention in against Serbia during you know, the Balkan Wars in the 90s. But again, I think we're better off being in dialogue with them, or even arguments with them if we have to, than to, you know, withdraw, which some people in this Green Party in the United States are advocating. I think, you know, we have something to contribute to that conversation. We have a certain perspective, being at the belly of the beast of U.S. imperialism. And by the same token, and I just posted something to the National Committee list about this today, East European Greens, as well as other lefties, you know, socialists and anarchists, have perspectives on what's going on in Ukraine and the whole, you know, question of peace and self-determination and independence and sovereignty in Eastern Europe. And those Greens, you know, they sometimes look at, you know, because you'll get the argument here that, well, we don't have anything to say about that. We should just oppose our imperialists and, you know, leave Russia alone. And, you know, that aggravates the hell out of lefties in Ukraine and the rest of Eastern Europe, because it's like they're getting threatened or even invaded, as in Ukraine. And they have certain perspectives. They want support. They want humanitarian aid. They want arms. They want diplomatic support. And instead, we got some people on the left in this country saying, well, NATO provoked the whole thing, as if NATO made Russia invade Ukraine. We can be critical of NATO's policies. We should be. But that doesn't excuse the Russian invasion. And it just drives lefties in Ukraine and the rest of Eastern Europe crazy when they hear this from the Western left that has a hard time condemning Russia's aggression and supporting the fight for national liberation in Ukraine. So there's a case where we can learn from the Greens and other lefties in a region, in this case, East Europe. So it definitely benefits to coordinate. There is a thing called the Global Greens, and it's really very loosely organized. It's more a forum format in which to communicate and discuss. You really can't make decisions on behalf of the parties. And most of the parties probably aren't prepared to participate in that kind of structure because they can't afford to send delegates to international meetings. And that includes the United States. Most of our people that have gone to these meetings have been self-funded. And you got to have elected people funded by the party to really have a democratic process. So we got a ways to go there, but by the same token, we should, you know, I believe, stay in these organizations, and where we have disagreements, you know, argue it out, have a debate. Gene Lowe's Pascalides. DeSantis is putting veterans in the classroom to solve the teacher shortage. Veterans who are not teachers, who don't have the qualifications. That to me is just the grossest pandering. And, veterans, just like anybody else who is teaching, should be paid a reasonable salary. And they don't do that in Florida, where he's at. So, DeSantis is bad news. He's as bad as Trump, probably worse than Trump on policy, because Trump's only policy was Trump first. DeSantis is a right-wing ideologue, and he's half competent compared to Trump, who, couldn't remember at the end of a sentence what he said at the beginning of it. So, DeSantis is somebody that needs to be defeated and opposed. Blind Boy Wilson, the elephant in the room is ridiculously high tuition. Yeah, it's the elephant in Biden's room. It's not in our room because we, talked about that. We need price controls on tuition like they have in Australia. Any particular course of study should have a maximum price on it. Because the tuition and college costs have been inflating at a ridiculous rate for decades. And as I discussed earlier, part of it's due to the way they finance student loans, and the colleges can take advantage of that to make money. And that's got to be changed as well. It's the elephant in the room of the national debate for the most part. But hopefully our little debate here and, giving you some links to Matt Bruning's discussion of the actual implications of Biden's policy on tuition, we'll begin to get, more people aware of what the issue is and how to fight it. I commented on the release of the Trump affidavit. Yeah, I see in the chat, Blonde Boy Wilson also said, we need to stop talking about Trump while Biden and Clinton remain free. No, I don't think we should stop talking about Trump, but not sure what crimes Biden and Clinton, unless you were talking about war crimes. There we go. And of course, then that becomes, well, what format do we have for war crimes? The United States is not part of the International Criminal Court. Russia is not part of the International Criminal Court. We got a Security Council where the great powers veto each other. So the UN is hobbled. One of the things that the left in Ukraine has raised is reforming the UN, making it more democratic so these imperialist powers can't veto each other and hamstring the UN. They've also, this was when, before the big invasion, February 24th, but while the conflict in the Donbas was stalemated, bringing in UN peacekeepers to police that, because there was a Minsk agreement that neither Ukraine or Russia really implemented their sides of it. So it really didn't happen and the front was frozen. Although contrary to Russian propaganda, there was no big invasion or, genocide toward Russians in the Russian occupied area. Basically, if you look at the statistics from the organization OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, who have monitors there, most of the deaths happened in the first year. They're about equal on either side, both for combatants and civilians. And in 2021, I think a total of 16 people died, most of them due to landmines that had been planted earlier, most of them in the first 6 months of that year. None were killed this year before Russia invaded. So there was no big genocide or war going down in the Donbas. It was a stalemate. So anyway, the left in Ukraine was saying, well, why don't we bring in UN monitors or UN peacekeepers to keep the sides apart. And if we ever get to the point where this war ends and there's a settlement, you know, that they may be needed. But of course, the record of UN peacekeepers is very checkered. Haiti and parts of Africa, there have been enormous atrocities. They basically went and ducked and hide in Bosnia when the Serbians were going after the Bosnian Muslims. They just, they had the arms, the troops, and they didn't engage to stop the murders. So bringing in the UN peacekeeping force has got to be a competent one that can do the mission. So how did I get, oh, I was talking about East Europe, left. Steve Talbot, are conservative ideas popular with some because large chunks of people are conservative, or are people conservative because it is temporarily popular? Interesting question. I think if you look at public opinion polling, on social issues, people tend to be conservative, but persuadable. I mean, look at what happened with gay marriage. In 2004, Karl Rove, on behalf of the Republicans, put a bunch of referendums on the ballot for people to vote against it. And that same year, Greens in New Paltz, New York, the mayor and the deputy mayor started marrying gay couples. The Democrats got an injunction. The attorney general I mentioned earlier, who resigned in disgrace for going to prostitutes, but he got an injunction against the Greens doing those marriages. That was then. By 2012, New York had legalized gay marriage. The big NGOs in the gay rights movement were saying we were going to start a backlash. What we did was start a movement. And by 2012, and I forget when the Supreme Court decision was, I think it was later that same year or around that period, maybe it was 2013, legalized gay marriage. So what I'm saying is on the social issues, people can be persuaded. Racial attitudes, even though we still have a big problem with racism, are much better now than they were in the 50s and 60s, let alone the 20s, when they were probably the worst they ever were in this country. So we can move people with conservative ideas. Now, on economic issues, people tend to be new dealers, even Republicans. You know, you talk to a lot of Republicans, grassroots, rank and file Republicans, they want single-payer health care. They want Social Security benefits increased. They want a lot of the things that, you know, a left kind of social democratic liberalism would be for. Now, are people conservative because it's temporarily popular? I think that's true of a lot of young people who are still finding their way, and they get in with a peer group where conservative, being even racist is cool. You know, a bunch of white boys. I ran into this when I was petitioning. And I think, you know, I actually saw this. I think I witnessed this. You all probably heard of Dinesh D'Souza. I saw him at Dartmouth College when he was a freshman. He was on the student government, and we were pushing for divestment from South Africa, and it took him weeks to make up his mind. And what I think I saw is he went to the right because the right was well-funded. People that funded the National Review were funding a group or a publication called the Dartmouth Review at Dartmouth College. And he saw that's where his bread was going to be buttered. And I think that's why he became a conservative. That's just, you know, my observation and hunch. I can't get inside his head, but it sure looked like that to me. He was looking which way the wind was blowing and where his best chance was to get ahead. So I think that happens. When I was in Connecticut, and one of the petitioners was talking about her brother, who our political ideas aren't well formed, but he's hanging out with conservatives, so he thinks he's a conservative, just so he can be in part of the crowd. So I think another thing is people conform to their group. And right now in white rural America, being a conservative is what everybody is. So people don't want to stand out. So I think that's part of it too. Most people aren't ideological. I mean, when it comes to policy, they're just like pretty practical. Yeah, I can't afford health insurance. If there was a, you know, government program that would cover me, like Medicare covers seniors, I'm for that. And or if they're a senior and they weren't able to, you know, get a pension or retirement funds squirreled away, and they're living on Social Security. It's not enough. So therefore, increasing Social Security benefits, even if they describe themselves as conservative, they support that idea, which is anathema to ideological conservatives. So that's the best I can say about that. And I guess we're up to the hour. So yeah, what's coming up is hopefully some more local candidates. Next Thursday, I'll be on Matt Ho's live stream talking about electoral reforms. The publicity will be out on his media, social media, and my social media soon. You might want to tune into that. So yeah, we'll get some local candidates. I'm going to the Socialism 2022 conference in Chicago. When is it, the weekend? Is it next weekend? Yeah, it's next weekend. So I will be broadcasting next weekend from that, and I'll try to grab a good guest to be on the show then. And one of the people there is a Ukrainian socialist who, even if I am able to get her for that, I would like to have her back and really just deal systematically with some of these tropes that are denying the agency of the people of Ukraine and the left there in particular, and get caught all up in these geopolitical abstractions, you know, which imperialism, U.S. or Russian, to support, or rather than be independent of both and support national liberation of Ukraine. She's very good on that, and I hope to persuade her to come on the program. Her name's Yulia Yurchenko, and she has a book. If you want to slog through something that's very kind of heavy but very informative, it's called Ukraine and the Empire Capital, from marketization to armed conflict, or armed conflict. And it goes through the whole period from Ukraine's independence in 91 through 2018. So the armed conflict, you know, the war has been going on since 2014. It just was escalated radically by Russia in February. So I hope to get her on here and you know, sort of deal with, I'll give her some, you know, questions that you hear from, you know, based on, you know, some of the things some people in the left and peace movement are saying. So she can answer that, and then have her on to answer your questions. And if I can get her, I'm going to suggest we go longer, because I think she's somebody really worth listening to. And you can look up her stuff online. She had a great interview in Workers' Liberty, another one in Spectre, left-wing publications. Particularly the Workers' Liberty one, if you want to look that up. So that's what's coming up. And we're out of time. So like I always say, you know, keep organizing locally, building your local green chapters and organizations, and keep fighting, because social change happens in steps, not just as a smooth progression. So you might think you're not getting anywhere, but you're actually preparing the ground, changing people's minds, and getting to the point where suddenly everybody's with you. And you never know when that's going to come. You know, who knew Occupy would break out, even though we knew the contradictions that led to that, the growing wealth inequality, the bailout of the bankers, but not the people. All that was simmering, and it just happened to come out that fall of 2011. And that was probably stimulated by what was going on with the Arab Spring and similar movements in countries like Spain and Greece. Just keep fighting, and you know, one of these days we're gonna break through to the next level. So have a good week, everybody, and we'll see you next week.